Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. How many decisions do you think you've already made today? According to today's guest, Narina Hertz, we have to make up to 10,000 trivial decisions every single day, 227 just about food. Caffeinated or decaf? Small, medium, large, or extra large? Colombian, Ecuadorian, Ethiopian, fair trade? Hazelnut, vanilla, unflavored, cream, milk, sugar, sweetener? You get the picture. If you make the wrong choice when it comes to your coffee, it doesn't matter much, right? But you make the wrong choice when it comes to your finances, your health, your work, you could end up sicker, poorer, or out of a job. And if your decisions relate to others, your parents, your children, your company, your country, your staff, the choices you make can irreversibly impact the direction their lives are going to take as well, not only today, but in the months and the years ahead. Narina Hertz has been a guest on this show before, on her earlier books, but they were both about global economics. Her new book, Eyes Wide Open, is subtitled How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World. And you can bet I'm going to ask Narina how she decided on such a departure. In any case, I think this is a welcome subject as we face the choices of a new year, and I hope you'll decide to stay tuned. On Free Forum, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Narina Hertz, best-selling author and strategist, graduated from university at the age of 19. By the age of 23, she was advising the Russian government on its economic reforms, and at 29 was working with the governments of Israel, Egypt, Palestine, and Jordan on the Middle East peace process. Her books have been prescient. In The Debt Threat, she predicted the 2008 financial crisis. And in The Silent Takeover, she anticipated that unregulated markets and massive financial institutions would have serious global repercussions. Her latest book, as I said, is Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World. Professor Hertz is based at University College London. Welcome again to Free Forum, Narina Hertz.
It's great to be here, Terrence.
Very good. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about, and I gave a brief bit of bio there. But tell us in your own words briefly a bit about your path to the work that you do today, and feel free to mention mentors or turning points or moments of decision.
Sure. Well, as you rightly say, Terrence, and you know, I've known you now for many years, coming on to speak about my previous books. This book is a departure in some ways from my previous work, because my previous books were really very big political books about how powers, economic powers, were changing and the implications this had for democracy and also for the stability of the world itself. My first book, The Silent Takeover, was all about big multinational companies and the power that they were now assuming in our society and the implications this had for democracy. My next book was about debt, sovereign debt, and about financial institutions and the instability that they were creating. So this book isn't about these big geopolitical issues, but actually I think it's as political really in its heart as my earlier works, because it's a book that's really about empowering us as individuals to be able to make smart choices, smart decisions, without just having to blindly follow expert opinion, conventional wisdoms, or even the crowd.
Okay. Now, your bio, as I read it, mentions some very early successes, right? Graduating university at 19, pretty serious responsibilities in your 20s.
Yes.
Narina, what was that like? And how does it feel looking back on those sort of heady young times from the mature perspective of one's mid-40s? And I only say it because I read it, the mid-40s part, several times in the press, so I feel I'm free to say that.
You are free to say it. I know. When I hear that bio, I think, gosh, doing all those things so young, it's quite incredible. And then I think, oh, that was me doing all those things so young. I think in a way, what made it perhaps easier was I cut my teeth in these very strange environments. Russia in the early 90s, so just as it was, as the Soviet Union had kind of collapsed and Yeltsin was coming into power. So it was a time when I was working there, initially advising the Russian government on its reforms and then becoming a critic of what the West was advising the Russian government to do. There was no clear roadmap that you had to have had lots of experience to follow in order to be able to give useful input.
Yeah, there had never been a situation where the Soviet Union or some entity that large had collapsed and switched programs. This was new territory. It was a startup for everyone.
Exactly. It was very uncharted territory. And actually, I think if anything, I was at an advantage coming in young, fresh, without a lot of preconceived ideas and beliefs about how things should be done. And arguably, that was one of the mistakes that the big Western advisors of the time made, was that they were so locked into their own way of thinking that they weren't able to step back and think, actually, this is a very different environment, and what works in America may not work here in Russia.
And let me just cut in one more time, Narina, and say,
sure.
Just sort of hint or foreshadow, that kind of a blind spot of thinking that the present recreates the past or that this recreates what you've done before is one of the warnings you give people, or one of the things you say people need to do in decision making in their personal lives as well.
Yes, very much so. I mean, it's a trap we can also easily fall into, especially if what's worked in the past for us has been successful.
Exactly.
If it's something that's worked, then we think, oh, yes, this worked really well. You know, I'm going to go and replicate it. But in a world that's as fast-moving and fast-changing as ours, that isn't necessarily going to pay off. I mean, just ask Nokia. That company was the mobile phone company of all time. In the, before in the 90s, it was the company. 4 out of every handset sold globally were Nokia. And when Apple developed the iPhone, Nokia really was left sleeping on the job. And it actually turned out, which I found really remarkable when I was doing my research, I discovered that Nokia engineers had actually developed a whole host of features very similar to the iPhone. They developed swipe and touch screen. And when they took that to Nokia management said, no, we know what's made us successful. These things aren't what Nokia's about. They're not what make us successful. What people want is a phone that you can drop from great height where the screen won't smash.
Yeah.
As we know, that hasn't done Apple. hasn't created problems for Apple.
So. No, it's so funny. I know I interviewed Jaron Lanier recently, and he points out the, of course, even bigger than Nokia, I think, is the Kodak situation, where a company that was not just a leading competitor, but was synonymous with photography, missed the boat on digital photography, even though they had developed a digital, they were one of the first to develop digital and didn't go forward with it. Let me go back to the second half of my question, just so they get to know you
sure.
again a little more personally.
Sure.
Does one feel, when one has those kinds of early influence and early successes and gets press for it and so on, is there a point in the intervening years where you have to live up to that whole thing that we know about young people, that they're immortal, that they that nothing, you know, that there are no limits and so on? You get where I'm going. How does current-day Narina deal with that, or have you had to?
Well, I mean, it really was a baptism by fire. I mean, when I wrote The Silent Takeover, and that was a big success, and so I was, I think, just 30 when it came out. So, you know, I'd had my early adventures, and then that, and I'd continued having adventures, and then I wrote a book that was a big success. I was still young. And the first event that I ever got asked to speak at when the book came out, I was asked to sit on a panel with Bill Clinton.
Mm.
And yeah, so it really came very fast, and And it was very unexpected, actually, that side of my life. And it opened up. What happened was that it just opened up a whole exciting new world, which I was able to go on interesting journeys and paths and work with, you know, fascinating people and advise interesting presidents and prime ministers and leaders thanks to that. So actually the journey kind of kept on building on each other. But this book, actually, there's also a personal reason.
Let me tell people, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Nerina Hertz, economist and best-selling author of The Silent Takeover, The Debt Threat. And we're talking about her new book, Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World. And you can learn more at Nerina.com. That's N-O-R-E-E-N-A, her first name, Nerina.com. But before we get to the present book, we've got some time here, as you know. Let me just ask you to look back also at the books, The Debt Threat and The Silent Takeover. Yeah. 2001's The Silent Takeover, you write about the rising dominance of global corporations over our lives and what's left of democracy. Looking back, how have things gotten better or worse? What would you say, you know, if you were doing a prologue in 2013 to that book, what's happened in the intervening dozen years?
Well, I think one thing that clearly has happened is that those views, which were seen as incredibly radical at that time, you know, very, very viewed by various commentators as very radical, are now pretty much accepted by, I'd say, most people.
Yeah.
Which is partly, unfortunately, because there hasn't been that much change in a lot of regards. Corporations continue to wield incredible power on affecting government policy.
Yeah, as we saw, when the global economy crashes due to overreach, due to screwed up incentives and risk assessment and so on, here we are. Say that was 07, 08. Here we are. Mm-hmm. Half a decade and more passed, and chastised, humbled, hardly.
No, I mean, exactly. So all this money went into bailing the banks out. And what happened? The rich got richer. The banks barely seem to have taken really any significant hit. And things have pretty much gone back to normal. Here in the UK, there are ongoing conversations, you know, that are continuing about bankers' bonuses, the short-termism of the markets. There's some key structural issues that still haven't been resolved despite the crisis.
Yeah, and no, I mean, I know we have been very lax over here in terms of a number of things, but the one I'm going to mention is derivatives, credit default swaps, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I get the sense Europe has done a little better in patrolling these.
Not much, I guess. It's proven to be very hard to get the concerted, coordinated agreement that's needed in a global world in order to address the risks and govern these sorts of products.
Mm-hmm.
There doesn't seem to be the appetite globally for reaching agreement and saying, okay, you know, we all agree that we will restrict it. And so what that means is that, and it was a problem that I wrote about back in 2001. So companies shop for more favorable regulatory regimes. Governments say that they can't impose the regulations needed because corporations will move.
It will give a competitive advantage to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah. But over the past 13 years, there have been at the same time some companies who, and I think it really has been thanks to particular leaders who have said, actually, this doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense from a business point of view, even. not only is this a matter of ethics, it actually doesn't make business sense to be ignoring the environment, ignoring human rights, ignoring labor standards. And so what we've seen in, over the past 13 years is at the same time as little has been done at a regulatory level, and many companies are continuing in pretty much the same way they were. There are some companies which have risen above, put their heads above the parapet. I mean, I'm thinking of a company like Unilever, which has really made big commitments to sustainability and not just talking the talk, but actually walking the walk. And other companies too. And I think they're often driven by a leader who wants to leave a legacy mm-hmm. that goes beyond the bottom line.
Yeah, and go, as you referred before, to short-termism. Someone who is concerned about a legacy, even if it's his personal drive and his personal legacy that he's concerned about, that does give them more of a long-term perspective.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So the 2005 book, The Debt Threat, How Debt is Destroying the Developing World and Threatening Us All, what's interesting, of course, is that debt was threatening the developed world more than most people knew at the time as well. You wrote about how major players in the developed world were ensnaring the developed countries in vicious cycles, deeper and deeper debt at the expense of critically needed infrastructure, healthcare, and so on. What about the intervening 8 years in that situation?
Well, in that era, there was progress, and my book, I think, played a part in that. In that the book became one of the intellectual foundations for the cancellation of developing country debt movement in the, I think in the US as well, it was called the Jubilee.
Jubilee movement, yeah.
Yeah, Jubilee.
From the movement. Biblical Jubilee.
Yes, and so actually that it was an era where where things happened, where governments, it was a case where governments did come together, where agreements were made, where debts, significant amounts of debt were cancelled. So I think we can see that the positive effect of that in, a region like Africa, which is, has been experiencing exponentially more growth.
Mm-hmm.
In these past 8 years than it was in the previous decade.
Decades, so, yes, exactly.
Yeah, decades. So I think that was where we saw a positive. Where, of course, we're all aware where things didn't pan out well at all was when it came to developed country debt.
Yeah.
And that was something that in my book, The Debt Threat, which, although it was focused on developing countries at the time. In one chapter, I talked about my experiences witnessing the debt trading floor at an investment bank. And from that research, it had become very clear to me, and I wrote about it in the book, that this whole cycle of debt was very perilous, not just developing country debt, but developed country debt, that it was getting out of control. Because I mean, it's really quite incredible. You're on a trading floor, and the way people are talking about debt, which obviously has huge implications for a country and for people who live in a country, because if you have to repay debt, that means you don't have money to put into public services, or you don't have money to put into schools, and you don't have money. I mean, this money has to come from somewhere. It was amazing how disconnected from that the traders were, and how if something bad happened in a country, that could be great for them if they were holding a particular position.
Oh, yeah. For them, debt is just another widget they're selling.
Exactly.
Yeah. And finally, one last question before I move into the new book. You wrote a couple of years ago an article in which you said you saw the gradual demise of what you called Gucci capitalism mm-hmm. to be followed by a responsible capitalism or a cooperative capitalism. Talk just a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, in the wake of the financial crisis, as I think some other optimistic folk perhaps felt at the time, that surely from this terrible situation, something good would happen, that people would realize that the pendulum of capitalism had just swung too far in one direction, and that self-interest without any sense of collective interest was going to ultimately destroy everyone. And so I started looking at kind of signs that there was this more cooperative, collaborative capitalism emerging that actually delivered pretty well, and whether that was communities like Freecycle or Couchsurfing, where people
the sharing economy,
whether it was the sharing economy, which, you know, since I wrote the article has really been growing very significantly, or whether it was co-creation, so, you know, open source, Linux, Wikipedia, but now some of the things I touch upon in my new book, co-creating of information, that there were these signs that there was an alternative form of capitalism existing. Capitalism still, but recognizing that actually with a common interest and a shared interest, we could actually perhaps do better.
Yeah. And there's also been, it seems to me, a growth of cooperatives
as an
entity.
Model.
Yeah.
Yes, and with really a lot of success in a lot of cases, not in all cases, but overall. And I looked at how cooperative businesses were faring in general compared to normal businesses in the downturn. They were faring significantly better.
Mm-hmm. In Spain, I know that the cooperative section, the Basque section with the cooperatives, has been weighed down by the rest of the country. But be that as it may, they have not been as hurt as the cutthroat capitalism of the rest of the country.
And that's true of cooperative businesses in Italy, in Canada, in Switzerland, as well. I mean, we're seeing data for all those countries.
And hopefully they will keep growing in this country. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Rena Hertz. She's the best-selling author of The Silent Takeover and The Debt Threat, which we just spoke about. And now we will shift to speaking about her newest book, Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World. And you can learn more at Norena.com, Noreena.com. Okay. So as I implied in the intro, I was a bit surprised to see this. I mean, really, when it arrived, you know, the notices first arrived, I went, well, this is a big departure, as I said, from economics about global issues to one that seems more a mix of science journalism, self-help, you know, those sort of categories. First, is that a fair reaction? And then, if you would, taking into account the information and advice in your own book, tell us about your decision-making process in choosing to embark in a new direction.
Mm. Well, I'll start with that, actually, because
okay.
I think that helps give context for why I wrote this book and what I hope readers will get from it. So, yes, as we've kind of already discussed, I had this lots of adventures working on very interesting, big, geopolitical, global subjects. And life was interesting and challenging and good. And then about 6 years ago, I got very sick. And I was in a lot of pain. I lost a lot of weight, kind of 30 pounds in weight. Nobody knew what was wrong. And I spent about 8 months seeing doctors in the US and in the UK, trying to figure out what was wrong, and I realized as I sat in one of my many doctors' consulting rooms, I realized here I was, somebody who had been advising global leaders on big decisions, for the preceding decade, but I hadn't thought that much about the process of decision making, about how we make decisions. And so in between kind of MRI scans and CT scans and spinal taps, I started investigating the whole literature on decision making in neuroscience, in psychology, in my field, in economics. There's a big literature as well. Really trying to piece together what does it take to make smart decisions so that you don't just have to do what the first doctor you see tells you, so that you don't have to just blindly accept what a government spokesman says. I mean, how can we be empowered decision makers ourselves? And then when I did get well, which thankfully I did, I continued this journey and started interviewing some of these smartest decision makers out there, a real range of people from fighter pilots to ER doctors to Hollywood moguls to hedge fund honchos, trying to piece together again what it takes to make smart decisions so that we can be empowered citizens making the right choices for ourselves.
Yeah, just one statistic I picked up. You say that 1 in 5 patients are misdiagnosed, that in the U.S. and Canada, 50,000 hospital deaths each year could be prevented if the real cause of illness is correctly identified rather than such a mistake. And that's life and death, and it's
terrifying.
Big numbers.
Yeah, shocking numbers. And yet we give so much power to those who have an expert label.
Right.
There was an interesting piece of research that I talk about in my book where people were put into a brain scanner, an MRI brain scanner, and their brain movements were looked at as they listened to an expert's advice. And what happened was, as they contemplated the expert's advice, it was as if the independent decision-making parts of their own brains switched off, and they just trusted what the expert said, whether it was right or wrong. So we have this physiological response.
Deep.
And
it seems to me, you certainly make this point, but it seems to me in areas where it seems we, the layman, we, the civilian, whatever, are not as informed, which I would think is health, where we think we defer to doctors, financial, where we think it's all too complicated and we defer to advisors. And then there's some level at which this also happens with the military, intelligence, those sorts of people where everyone's sort of, well, if you knew what they knew, right?
Yes. And
so this idea of challenging experts, what did you learn about how people learn to do that?
About how we can do that?
Yeah. In other words, if it seems to be the world is, you know, this confusing, complicated world, it seems like I can't learn everything. So that's what experts are for. How do we get around that?
Well, the first thing to do is to try and arm ourselves so that we can have a proper dialogue with an expert, if it's an expert that we have the opportunity to have face-to-face interaction with.
Such as our doctor, our financial advisor.
Exactly. You have to be able to at least be able to ask the right questions and be able to understand their answers. I mean, those are two basics. And if you can't do it yourself, who in your network can help you? You know, because if you're sick, if you're the patient, you know, it just may not be possible for that person to be you. Or if your child's sick, you may be up all night with your child in the hospital. You may not have the head to do it. So who in your is there someone in your network who can help you? There's the first thing to so that at least you can have that conversation, that dialogue.
I'll tell you what. I suffered a staph infection in my knee in the middle of the summer, which I'm now, you know, 90% back from. But the first three appointments I had with my doctor, I took my fiance and a nurse practitioner.
Right, exactly. And was that before you had read the book?
I was going to say, and that was before I'd read the book. So I feel like I was onto something. But I knew this was absolutely uncharted territory for me. And doesn't matter how smart I am about other stuff, this was where I needed someone who, when, you know, would question in the office, but then afterwards we'd confer, and before we'd confer. And yeah, I mean, I certainly say I don't know that anything drastically different happened because of that, but I felt much more in control, much more on top of things, I think, because of that. Not leaving with that question I wish I'd answered. I wish I'd asked, I mean, you know, that sort of thing.
Yes, I think having that other person go with you is a very practical thing that makes a big difference. And having somebody to prepare your questions with beforehand as well.
Yes.
That's incredibly helpful.
I do remember the moment where I pulled out my little pad with questions at the end of one meeting, or what the doctor had assumed was the end of one meeting, and he made some sort of remark about anal retention. But
but one of the interesting things I found in my research also was that those really super confident doctors, ones who are whose attitude is I know everything, and you know the physician is God type.
Yeah,
they tend to perform worse. Worst.
I know that is. I read that. That is so interesting because they can't even learn from their own mistakes.
No.
Right?
Yeah,
not only can't they learn from anyone else, they don't learn from their own mistakes. We're at about the halfway point. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. The other voice is Nerina Hertz, economist, best-selling author of The Silent Takeover and The Debt Threat. And we're talking about her new book, Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World, which I believe is a great book and a great set of ideas to arm yourself with as you go into a new year, 2014. And you can learn more at Noreena.com, Noreena.com. We've focused on one of your tips, which I think is a big one, which is dealing with experts and expertise and so on. Let's take a step back. How is our decision-making here in the 21st century influenced by evolutionary factors that may not be as relevant today as they were thousands of years ago?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I think where we – let me give you an example. You hear a lion roar. Our evolutionary selves, the really smart response, of course, would be to run. You hear a lion roar, you run. Of course, today you could be hearing a lion roar because you're at the zoo and there's a lion behind a cage. You could be hearing a lion roar because you're watching the Jungle Book on DVD. So our evolutionary response to situations isn't always appropriate nowadays. So we see and we – so but often we get often we can get a very physical, visceral reaction to something, which actually isn't necessarily appropriate, the appropriate response for a situation that we're currently facing.
That makes good sense to me. In other words, this gut feeling, things as you say, visceral and primitive as a gut feeling or, you know, I would think the more visceral they are, the older they are in terms of our evolution, and perhaps the less appropriate they are to the current moment. And yet, as we know, that visceral feeling feels like certainty. It feels stronger than all that stuff going on in our rational mind.
Absolutely. We feel like we just know.
Yeah.
We just know. We just know not to trust this person. We just know to do this, that we like this, yes. And yet our guts can be tricked by so many things. I mean, that was one of the chapters in my book that touch upon this. It was such fascinating research from this research done on judges, on the why they granted parole to a prisoner. It was research done in Israel. Why judges granted parole? Was it because of the applicant's gender? Was it because of their ethnicity? Was it because of the type of crime? No, the greatest determinant for whether or not judges granted parole was whether the judge had recently eaten.
Yeah, no. That was, I mean, to think that lives hang in the balance.
Yes.
in those sorts of things.
If you went before the judge, just before they had their mid-morning snack, that was a terrible time to go before the judge. You had a 0% chance of getting parole. If you went just after his snack, that shot up to 65%. Just before lunch, plummeted to 10%. Just after lunch, back to 65%. So, so whether you've eaten, there was research done where they gave, it was in Canada, this piece of research, where they gave male undergraduate students a photograph either of a Victoria's Secret model or of a neutral object, a rock, to look at. And then they gave them a financial decision to make. The guys who'd been looking at the Victoria's Secret model made significantly worse financial decisions than the guys who'd been looking at the rock.
Yeah, no, I think that is interesting. In other words, what you're saying is it isn't just stress. In other words, that looking at that Victoria's Secret model may have actually seemed pleasurable. But whatever it was, it was not it was interfering with your decision-making process. I think that's fascinating. You know, that emotion of any sort may cloud your decision-making.
And emotions, you know, of course, stress, anxiety. You know, when I was sick, one of the when you're sick, you know, you're obviously more anxious, you're more tunnel-visioned, you're more risk-averse. So we need to be aware of our emotions. When we're angry, we're less trusting of people. And it turns out that actually just being aware of our emotions, so noting our emotions, saying to yourself, I'm feeling anxious today because I'm waiting for my medical test results, or I'm feeling really happy because I just got a promotion. Just noting that to yourself seems to serve as an emotional thermostat, and it regulates our decision making, so it goes back to a much more optimal state.
So, in other words, if you ignore, don't pay any attention to emotions, and you're making decisions, your decision making is compromised. You don't know it, but you're saying if you will just note your emotional state, your feeling state, whether you're hungry or not, I would imagine also these sorts of things. Just noting it gives you the advantage of taking it into account, or does just noting it make you better already?
With the emotional state, it's literally the mindfulness of the noting.
Wow.
That in itself. And they've started doing some really interesting research with Buddhist monks, people who meditate on a regular basis. And there's some interesting research coming out which is suggesting that people who meditate regularly make better decisions, and that's partly because the part of their brains which is about noting emotions is just much better practiced and much better developed. So think about the noting emotions itself, which enables us to
regulate. That's just great. That's just great. Let me just read a couple of things that I picked up along the same line, and you can comment or not. That stress makes us more prone to tunnel vision, which makes sense, again, going back to evolution. The chemicals that come up in stress are the ones that would come up with threat or predator, and at that point, it probably is smart to focus tunnel vision and not worry about whether you're going to eat or have sex, you know. Anxiety makes us more risk-averse. That seems to be related the same way. We feel anxiety. It reminds us we're in a threat situation, so let's not take any chances. And as you – the one that was interesting, you talked about judges, but you said studies of judges and doctors reveal that when stressed, they revert to unconscious racial stereotyping.
Yes. There's research around – doctors, the diagnoses that they make. Been some research around heart attacks. More likely to think that people are feigning symptoms, that it's not that serious. If it's an ethnic, if it's a particular ethnicity in front of before them. In a high stress situation, in an emergency type situation, judges, when they are more stressed, fall back on their racial stereotyping. which is obviously very worrying.
Yeah, no, that I mean, that kind of stuff is striking because, in fact, what we've just done is we've said we start out talking about experts. Well, judges and doctors are experts, and when stress makes that kind of change in them, it's rather important. I did a show just recently with Rick Hansen on his book Hardwiring Happiness. We talked about things. A lot of his work is how to deal with evolution's negativity bias. That is the bias that we focus more on negative cues or threats, as we've mentioned. We remember them more easily. There's a tendency of them to install in our brain's neural structure more quickly than good thoughts or feelings. But it sounds like Talis Charo's work on the optimism bias and a couple of the things that you say seem to be in conflict with that, and I'm not sure I understand. You say, for instance, it's crucial to ask probing questions of ourselves. All of us show bias when it comes to the what information we take in. We typically focus on anything that agrees with the outcome we want. That seems not the negative bias. You also say, be aware the glass is not always half full. Listen to what you don't want to hear. When neuroscientists put volunteers through a brain scanner, they discovered that up to 80% of us dismiss information on the likelihood of bad things happening to us and pay more attention to the good stuff. How do these two biases work?
Well, Telly Sherrod's work was very interesting because, she asked people, she said to people, you know, what do you think the probability of getting cancer is, or being burgled, or you know, a whole host of bad things that could happen to them. And then she told them what the actual risk was. So if they thought the risk of getting cancer was 20%, if she just said to them, oh, do you know what, it's actually 30% or 40%, so something worse, people didn't take this new information in. And when she looked at their brains, as she was giving them this information, you could see that that part of the brain was not really active. Whereas if she gave them information that was better than they expected, so you think your risk of getting cancer is 20%, but it's actually 5%, then people's brains really went into overdrive and they really took that in. And she found that pretty consistently. The only group of people that she found didn't behave like that were people who were depressed. Yeah, so the other piece of research, which I found really, you know, very interesting and kind of made sense actually to me, was that we are really drawn to information that confirms what we already believe.
Yep.
So if you think house prices are going to go up, then every article which talks about house prices going up, that's what you're going to be, like a magpie, kind of focusing in on that and really taking that in. And it turns out we get a dopamine rush when we come across that sort of supporting information that's similar to as if we'd eaten chocolate, had sex, or fallen in love. So
so that's the confirmation bias, yeah.
Yeah, that's the confirmation bias. So I think these are interesting phenomena. I think when it comes to Telly Sherrod's work is quite recent, and I don't think we understand yet why necessarily the people responded in that way. Maybe it's something to do with how numbers are framed and the way we think about percentages and risk more generally. Because we definitely don't think about numbers and risk and percentages and probabilities in very robotic computer-like ways at all. There was some other research that I talk about in the book where, you know, people respond differently to a risk if it's presented in a percentage form or a fraction form. So if you're told, or a ratio form, so if you're told there's a 1 in 10 chance. They did this experiment with psychiatrists, and they gave them an example of a mentally ill patient in a secure institution. And they said, you know, if you're told he has a 1 in 10 chance of attacking, would you let him out? If you were told he had there was a 10% chance of him attacking, would you let him out? And there was a big difference in responses depending on whether people had been given 1 in 10 or 10%. 1 in 10 people could visualize a situation. 10% couldn't really visualize it, so you had a a much less strong response.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, one of your big tips is to brush up on math, get better with numbers.
Yeah.
People may think that now that we have calculators and computers, they don't have to know this stuff. When the time comes, they go to that. But you're saying no. For exactly the I assume the kinds of reasons you were just talking about, that a fraction and a percentage are the same, and the more literate you are and the more at home you are with numbers, the more likely you are to use them to your advantage.
Yes, and that chapter in the book, which a lot of people have really responded to, I think gives some very practical ways that we typically can be tricked by numbers, things like graphs and how the X and Y axis and how what's on them can really distort the information that you're being given, or about how sample sizes are created and polls. And so when you're looking at surveys and you're looking at results, or you're looking at a graph in a newspaper, or you're looking at a financial advisor's chart, we need to be aware of the ways that numbers can be manipulated. And so many people, it turns out, have math anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when they think of a math problem, when they know that they're going to be confronted with any sort of numerical problem, they actually feel very, very anxious.
So now you've got two problems, right? One, you're not good at math, and two, you're anxious. And neither one of them is going to help you make a good decision.
And they actually feel the same sort of pain as if it was physical pain. I mean, it's that bad, that feeling of math anxiety in many people, not only people who are not good at math, interestingly. You can even be somebody who's pretty number literate but and yet have this dread of numbers.
Yeah, that is fascinating. And I mean, it seems like it would be something that I would imagine in a way is only getting worse. I would say because we have the tools now, so we can sort of slough it off. And yet, I think the presentation of numbers, the deluge of numbers is greater than ever. Let me remind people again, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Nerina Hertz. We're talking about her new book, Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World. And her website is nerina.com. We referred early on about crowdsourcing in terms of a positive thing economically. You also suggest crowdsourcing advice and information.
Nowadays, going back to illness just as an example, if you have a chronic condition, you are probably better served finding the Facebook group of people with your condition or Yahoo group, and finding out how people are coping with it and getting tips and ideas and sharing information there than going to your overworked family doctor, who is much less likely to be up to speed with latest research. Health, we see it nowadays on our Facebook feeds, don't we? People posting, I'm thinking of getting a new computer, what would you recommend?
Mm-hmm.
Going out to your network. So I think there are ways that we can easily reach out to a broader constituency. People who've got experience of a situation and are sharing their direct experience. But sometimes we maybe take this a bit too far. There are times when I'm poring over TripAdvisor reviews and I suddenly have to stop myself and think, who is, why am I taking Joe from Idaho's reviews so seriously? What is the chance that his tastes are going to be like mine, that he's going to like the same sort of holiday hotel experience that I am? So we have to also think about where we're getting the information from.
Right. But there has been some research, and I imagine this is one that's going to be researched a lot, is this notion of the wisdom of the crowd and so on, although no one person is necessarily a reliable expert or has an informed opinion, somehow the crowd averages out to be wise.
It's not even averages. I mean, one of the cases that I write about is what happened in Japan after the terrible Fukushima nuclear explosion. And what happened there was that the government, the Japanese government, their official line was that there is no problem, you know, to the residents in the areas within a vicinity of the explosion. You know, there isn't a problem, there isn't, the radiation levels are safe. But worried citizens, concerned citizens, bought personal Geiger counters. You could buy them for $400, $500 at the time, and started monitoring their own readings and co-creating a map with their own readings, and which completely challenged and countered the official government response and actually showed that there was a problem. And I think we're going to see much more of this co-created information moving forward, you know, where, you know, technology is moving at a speed that is going to make this, you know, very easy for us all to be sharing information. You know, mothers taking the temperature of their children and that automatically being plotted then on a graph so that you'll be able to see children's flu outbreaks before anyone else spots them. So I think we'll see a lot more of that sort of information.
Yeah, and it seems to me they even now use tweets to track weather and health and things, because it's as reliable or more reliable than almost anything else they've got.
Yes, Google Trends has proved to be incredibly reliable. I mean, frequently outperforming the Centers for Disease Control's predictions on flu and on housing prices. And the Bank of England did a big study which revealed that by monitoring and in the US, similar studies have been done. So monitoring search terms like foreclosure and realtor, you're able to get a better sense of house price movements than you could from official government sources, and quicker.
It's wonderful and wild, this kind of stuff.
Yes.
You say, it's interesting, you say that it is impossible to give you one overarching strategy to follow, which I know publishers love. You know, so what's the overarching theme of all this, Norina? And you say there isn't one. What is the big takeaway, even if there isn't one overarching theme? What's if someone were saying, you know, they happened to catch you in a cab or something and said, so what's the best advice you can give me about my decision making?
Challenge others, challenge yourself, and carve out time to think. Carve out time and space to think. I mean, how many of us nowadays in our data deluged, perma-connected, constantly disrupted lives actually actively carve out the kind of time and space we need when we've got big decisions to make?
Very good. And it seems to me one other thing that I see threaded throughout of this is be aware, notice, pay attention, and be mindful.
Yes.
And so what some people, that kind of advice, as some people may think, is about spirituality or it's about Eastern mysticism or something. I keep finding, as I look at many issues through the course of a year on the show, that mindfulness, that thing of observing, taking stock, as you say, carving out moments to drop down, it seems to have benefits across the board that we discover new ones all the time.
Yes, so the old is proving is proving to be incredibly valuable.
Exactly. Okay. The book is Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World, and the website is Norina.com, Noreena.com. Thank you, Norina Hertz, and keep up the good work. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work and get involved in my work with organizations on story and narrative, go to my website. It's terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same one. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and four or five articles of background, you can sign up at the site, or you can email me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Free Forum podcast on iTunes. This program will be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. Go to Audio Archives and scroll down by date and time. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. My guest will be Daniel Goleman, the author of the groundbreaking bestseller Emotional Intelligence, about his newest book, and you will see how this fits with what we did this week. Next week, we're talking with Daniel Goleman about his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. So I'm trying to start myself and you off in this new year armed with some of the best intelligence on how to live this year well. Thanks a lot for being with me. I'll see you next week.